Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jane Gordon, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Connecticut, and author of Why They Couldn't Wait, a critique of the Black Jewish conflict over community control in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and Creolizing Political Theory, Reading Rousseau Through Fanon. She'll speak on the topic Slavery Then and Now, Passover Reflections. This program, sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 11, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Paul Williams, chairman of the Religious Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Dr. Gordon comes to us from the University of Connecticut, where she is an associate professor of political science. She has her PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, and she is an extraordinarily well-published, well-traveled, and gifted scholar. I pulled her resume from the web, and it's like 17 pages long, packed with fascinating material. One of the most interesting features of her research and her scholarship is the two key terms that I will present to you, and you can ask her to explain. One is creolization, and the other is transdisciplinarity. As I reflect on my own research in Central Africa, I find both of these terms extraordinarily useful, both for my research and for the way I conceptualize religious studies. And I'd like to read a quote from one of her recent articles on the net that I will speak to the issue of creolization, because I want her to speak to this question, and maybe she's planning on it. If you're not, okay, fine. She's got other issues, other fish to fry here, but that's all right. She says, creolization aims to contribute to the construction of an inhabitable social world, or one in which people can live together as human beings on terms that are neither degrading nor dehumanizing. There is much more to the concept than just that, but it is, I think, it's a lovely way of reflecting on the importance of scholarship and on the importance of living together in a world that seems increasingly difficult, dangerous, and monstrous. And with that, I'd like to highlight a book. If you want to read a really interesting but densely packed book, Of Divine Warning, authored by Jane Anna Gordon and Lewis R. Gordon, her co-author is her husband, Reading Disaster in the Modern Age, where they discuss the concept of the disaster and the disastrous and how that is transformed into the monstrous. And that is another thing. If she doesn't speak to this during the talk, ask her about this book. So I'm trying to plant a couple of seeds here and encourage her to speak to these issues, because I think they are powerful and they are in some ways linked, undoubtedly, to the topic that she will share with us today, which is Slavery Then and Now, Passover Reflections. Will you please issue a warm welcome to Dr. Jane Gordon as she comes up to speak. Thank you.
I wanted to begin by just thanking everybody here for the invitation to be here. For me, it's such a special thing to speak at the intersection of the Malcolm X Festival, Passover, and the photography exhibit that's taking place here, because they're the intersections of work that I do that don't typically converge. I'm usually trying to make them converge, but it's usually a lot of work. Sure. And so I can speak to some of the things that Paul mentioned, but I tried to actually focus this much more narrowly on slavery in the past and slavery in the present, but very much through the lens of Passover. And so, but I'm happy to talk about the other themes as well. I have to say, when Paul picked me up today, he said, you know, we have met before. And I thought, oh, God, because I usually remember people pretty well. And he said, in the 1980s in Chicago. I was probably about 8 at the time. So young woman was generous on your part. But okay, so... And I'm going to speak briefly because I actually look forward most to the discussion that I hope we can have. So, but one of the, so the Passover Haggadah, just as background, it really organizes the Seder, right? Which is the collective meal that people have together in their homes, which is supposed to retell the story of the Exodus, right? And it's full of instructions, it's full of injunctions, but I think in many ways the most significant one is the one that I want to read because it's going to organize everything I'm going to say. And what it says is, in every generation, we're obligated to consider ourselves as personally delivered from Egypt. Okay? So in every generation, we're obligated to consider ourselves as personally delivered from Egypt. Okay. So in terms of a learning experience aimed at cultivating identification, the Passover Seder could not be better. I mean, you got a sense of it here just a few minutes ago, right? And what I mean by that is it's organized around a series of questions that have to be answered over the course of the evening, and it's purposefully designed to be intergenerational. So the youngest person has to ask the questions that everybody assembled are then going to answer. But in addition to that, it's punctuated by these sensory experiences. So you have to taste the bitterness of slavery by dipping the parsley into the salt water twice, and you have to taste what mortar's like, right? And there's this palette of plagues that you create by dipping your finger into the wine and reciting them one by one. And at a certain point, you have to open the door and open and welcome in the prophet Elijah, right? So it's full of sort of getting up and doing. And so as a kid, it's always your favorite festival because it's aimed at you and it's aimed at forging this connection that you're instructed to feel. And the other thing that's also, I think, interesting about it is that it's also a porous it's a porous festival in the sense that it's constantly evolving. So for instance, my family, increasingly, we put an orange on the Seder plate. And similarly, we put a wine cup for Miriam beside the one for Elijah, because the whole aim is to fully reflect our Jewish foremothers as well as our Jewish forefathers, right? But the thing that I wanted to talk about right now is that what struck me are some of the subtle differences between how my primarily Black Jewish family celebrates Passover and follows that injunction, as opposed to the way that the primarily white family with which I grew up did. Because there's some, and there are obvious reasons for it, but what I want to suggest in a nutshell is that Black Jews are actually far better at following that injunction than their white counterparts are. And I think that that's something that we should try to address for the sake of Jewish people, for the sake of everybody, but also for the sake of just being decent Jews who are actually following what we're supposed to do on Passover, right? So I think the reasons for the difference are fairly straightforward and probably pretty clear. Right. So in addition to the fact that slavery is literally very recent, right? I was saying to Paul when we were eating lunch that when you're talking to American students, you have to remind them that even if you treat the official end date of slavery, which is right in the late 1800s, that's still very recent by most standards, right? And then if you add to that the fact that slavery wasn't actually eradicated with its formal abolition, then it's even more recent. I mean, people forget that there were people who were literally working on plantations unaware of the legal changes into the 1960s. I mean, forget about convict leasing and all of the other forms of neo-slavery. There was literal slavery until very, very recently in this country, right? So the idea of imagining oneself as literally delivered, divinely delivered from Egypt and from bondage is not a stretch, right? But then similarly, in addition to the formal abolition of slavery, most of the struggles for civil rights in this country, they're all about dealing with the ongoing legacies of enslavement that we haven't yet, you know, parted from the plantation grammar of the society, right? And so one of the things that strikes me is not only that, but also that if I teach Black political thought, and I'm particularly fascinated by the way that 19th century Black figures use the model of the ancient Israelites and Jewish scriptural and religious history to make sense of their own condition. So for instance, one of the people who I teach regularly is Alexander Crummell. And the question that he asked his primarily Black congregation was how to make sense of their enslavement. Why had they been enslaved? And was it because they were morally degenerate? Was it because they were weak? week, or was it because this was actually divine preparation? And his argument is that enslavement was divine preparation for a very unique calling, a form of election for blacks in the Americas. And when he does that, he makes the express comparison with the Israelites, right? And similarly, figures like Martin Delaney, when he was trying to make sense of why were Africans chosen to be oppressed in this country? And his argument is because Africans had a unique set of skills, a unique kind of know-how that people in this country needed. And again, when he makes the case, the example is, the comparison is with the Israelites. And so what strikes me is that Exodus is live and well and thriving when you look at black political thought throughout the Americas, right? The one thing that I would add to that, because I was listening to the Malcolm X presentations earlier, is that in some ways, Egypt has a much more ambivalent meaning, right, among African-American Jews. Because in Euro-modernity, right, Egypt is, in the end, is an African place, and it's the site of great civilizations. And so in many ways, Egypt becomes symbolic. Egypt is a lot like the Babylon of the Rastafarians, right? I mean, Egypt could be the United States. Egypt, is many other places. But while the meanings change, the sort of the living connection to it and to the idea of deliverance is very much there, right? And so before making the transition to talking about the way that that many white Jews celebrate Passover, I did want to say that while they're a numerical minority, there is definitely a history of white Jews who've also taken this injunction very, very literally. And if you look at the history of black studies programs in this country, the numbers are small, but there's always a Jew there. There's always an Ashkenazic Jew who is studying slavery or studying civil rights or whatever it may be. And I think in many ways, because I grew up with some of these people, right, they took this injunction very literally. They see it as a Jewish obligation to see oneself, however strange it may seem in this context, as a direct descendant of enslaved people in Africa. Right, and I'm thinking about in the studies of the history of slavery, there are figures like Moses Finley, Herbert Aptecker, my own childhood neighbor Robert Fogel. These are major contributors to the study of slavery. And what I find really interesting about them is that typically, in all the instances I know, they were raised in devout Jewish homes, but when they reached adulthood, they parted completely from Jewish religion and they saw their politics as their religion. Most of them were communists or socialists, but if you push them on why it was that they do the work that they do, they would all say it's an expression of their Jewish identity. And I say this because I know it intimately, and I would put myself in that camp. I mean, again, this sort of sounds far-fetched and weird, right? But when I heard this injunction every year, I sat there completely without irony, thinking, yeah, I'm a direct descendant of the people we are reading about. And for me, that raised not only a series of political questions, but also historical ones, right? So in other words, I thought, if we take very seriously that Jews are descendants of people who were in East Africa and the Middle East, how did they come to look like me, right? And it's pretty clear that the answer is conversion and intermixing. Right? And given how obsessed people are in America with racial intermixing, I started to wonder, what was the story actually like? How did European Jews become part of a faith that was African? And what does it mean for all of the obligations and implications today? Right? But one of the things that struck me both about the people I'm talking about and myself was that there's definitely a very clear sense that if the project of becoming fully American has to involve the project of becoming fully white, there's something very much at odds between being Jewish and that project. Right. And I think this was always very, very clear to me because of the particularities of my own upbringing, which is that I grew up moving back and forth between the South Side of Chicago by University of Chicago and apartheid South Africa, because my parents were both only children of aging parents. And what always struck me about the two places was that they had much more in common than people talked about them as having in common, right? That apartheid may not have been formal and legal on the South Side of Chicago, but in many ways it may as well have been. It was the most segregated city in America, right? And so it struck me in that environment that the need to struggle for direct deliverance was live and well in both of these contexts, right? But in some ways, the ways that my own family celebrated the Passover holiday was different from another model that I encountered later, right? And in that one, there was a real obsession with Jewish obligation. So for instance, the community I grew up in, the synagogue that I belonged to, was right across from where the Obamas lived before they went to DC. And it was a community of left-leaning liberals, and I had a socialist rabbi who loved to call out liberals. He said, you Jewish liberals, you're always here when we don't need you, and when we do, you're gone, right? And I was completely sympathetic. I thought he was like right on point, right? And I loved that he was calling out my parents and their friends, in front of sort of in a public place. But what was interesting about that community was they didn't eschew Jewish obligation, right? But when they thought about it, it wasn't about literal enslavement. It was about persecution. It was about struggles to assimilate. It was about anti-Semitism. It was about World War II. But Europe had completely displaced Persia, Andalusia, Egypt as the central focus. And the political struggles were much more about the effort to sort of close that final little gap towards being completely incorporated and assimilated into U.S. society or European society. Literal enslavement was very far from the picture, right? And so even so, I think that there were things that were commendable about it, right? So my folks are immigrants twice over. They moved from South Africa to England and England to the U.S. in a spate of 10 years. And even though they were white and English speaking, and so were spared all kinds of indignities that many other immigrants are, you know, are made to feel, there was a sense of not quite belonging. So they always invited our Palestinian friends over. They always invited all the immigrant friends over. There was a sense that being Jewish was about refugees, was about exile, was about diaspora, right? And so I was completely shocked when I went to college and encountered this other version of centering World War II, anti-Semitism, and Europe over this other past that I've been talking about. And there is this version of talking about anti-Semitism where it's about Jews making claims to being the prototypical victims of the modern world, right? And it's where the claim is that Jewish suffering can't be compared to any other form of suffering. It's not about making those relations. It's not about being intersectional. It's about the exact opposite of that. And when I first encountered this, I thought three things. I mean, one is, this is offensive. Second was, this is dangerous. And third is, this is very un-Jewish. Right? It's offensive because to treat one group's suffering as more significant than any other group of suffering that's predated it, that's simultaneous with it, that's followed it, is just offensive. It's not, that's not how you treat other human beings. It's dangerous because what it does is to completely mystify the origins of German fascism in ways that make us ill-equipped to recognize other brands of fascism that are alive and well and need to be challenged. So we don't actually gain the lessons that we should from centering that moment and that historical time period. It's very un-Jewish because if there's anything to the idea of Jewish election, it's actually very Du Boisian. The challenge is to make the world a reflection that could make the idea of God coherent, right? And saying that Jewish suffering is unique, prototypical, and not related to any other form of suffering is not that. I don't see how it could be construed as that, right? And so this model, I think, has no redeeming quality, right? And so one of the things I wanted to do, and I'm going to say a few more things and then wrap up, one of them is to say why I think it is that recentering literal enslavement is so necessary, regardless of, you know, for all Jews, black and white and everything in between. The first is that if you study the history of slavery, one of the things that's most remarkable about it is how few communities have been untouched by it. And this is one of the things that boggles my mind, is it's so rare to find a human community that doesn't have some experience of slavery, indenture, or some form of forced labor. It's the vast majority of humankind. Right? And so if what we're looking for is a meaningful way of thinking about the relationship of Jews to humanity that centers struggles for freedom, literal enslavement is it's the primary avenue for doing so. Right? Secondly, is just an argument that comes out of union politics, right? Which is that if you're looking to address varieties of unfreedom, you have to begin with the most radical form of its denial. Right? And so things like the effort to not fully belong is surely a manifestation of something that's actually a more profound version of that. This is the idea of if you raise the floor, you sort of raise the degree of disenfranchisement and degradation that's possible, right? And so in looking at slavery, you're looking at the floor and how it is that you would raise it. But then the third is a specifically religious question, which is that I think in many ways, the effort to treat human beings as tools and the effort to treat human beings as something other than human beings and how it is that you reconcile that with a God is one of the most pertinent, enduring theological questions of every faith, right? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that is, just as I was saying, there's one injunction that sort of colors the others. The question of theodicy is the religious debate that colors most others if you're thinking about issues of social justice, right? But having said all that, I think both black Jews and white Jews could do a better job when it comes to the Seder of thinking about contemporary forms of enslavement. And this is where I'm going to end. And there are many different reasons. Paul was showing me the exhibit here of photographs, and they're really remarkable. But one of the things that struck me in working on contemporary slavery is how many people are reluctant to call contemporary slavery slavery. And there are lots of different reasons for why, and I think many of them are really legitimate, and I'm going to try to spell some of them out and what I think are some of the answers. And this is something that I'm curious to talk through, right? But the first argument that many people make is they say, okay, there's no doubt that what's pictured in those photographs is horrific, it's denigrating, and it's dehumanizing, but it's not slavery, right? And the argument often goes, people who were trafficked were at least semi-voluntarily involved in what it is that took place. They were trying to migrate, they were trying to find work, and they were tricked. But there was some degree of voluntary intention that led to these results. It's an argument that's frequently made. A third argument that's often made, and I think this is actually one of the most significant ones, is to say that trafficking today, as horrible as it is overseen by criminal circuits, individual criminals, individual sadists. It definitely doesn't have the backing of law. It definitely doesn't have moral standing, and that part of what made racialized slavery so significant is it had moral backing. There are people who thought that this was a good, right? That this was absolutely legitimate. And when it comes to trafficking today, nobody's going to come out and say slavery is a good. Slavery is okay, right? Third, what a lot of people say is with trafficking, it's temporary. It's more like indenture, right? Very few people are born into it. Many people, you know, are freed. And so there's a reprieve. This isn't what it is to be born into slavery, to have generations that are enslaved, and to have that reality try to be normalized by other people around one, right? Another thing that people will often say is that that most work is alienated work. And so a lot of work is underpaid, sort of not voluntarily chosen, that sort of the norm of what it is to work is pretty terrible. And so this is maybe worse on the spectrum, but that to say that it's slavery is to assume an ideal of labor that doesn't exist hardly anywhere, right? The last is that many people will say that the very attention that's devoted to contemporary slavery, the fact that there's an exhibit like it here, is evidence of something very nefarious, which is that there's a willingness to look at this form of slavery so as to avoid the ongoing legacies of the plantation grammars of the society. That in other words, there's almost a sort of relief at looking at contemporary trafficking because it frees us from the history of enslavement in America and its grammar and its relationships and its norms. That this is different, at least there are other people involved, it's not black and white, there are women and children, you know, that at least this is different. And that the ease with which people can turn attention to it is a sign that there must be some kind of way that it's enabling us to evade neo-slavery as a living issue. Right. So I think there are answers to all of these. And I'm curious whether you find them convincing. So the first is that, and my sense from your faces as I was speaking is that you would share this view, is that nobody knowingly enters into trafficking. I mean, if people are entering into these kinds of fundamentally risky exchanges, it's an expression of how limited their options are. I mean, to seek migration through these means is already to face deep vulnerabilities, right? The second, though, is to say that while it's true that nobody endorses enslavement, nobody would do that, that people are perfectly, don't struggle at all to endorse policies that entrench the vulnerabilities that lead to enslavement. So, for instance, there are all kinds of issues that make people vulnerable to being trafficked that people have no problem going to sleep at night stomaching as acceptable, right? So if it's not an out-and-out endorsement, it's at least a complicit or tacit one, right? And while it's true that people who are trafficked may not be trafficked for life, what determines whether or not that's the case really has everything to do with the vulnerabilities with which they began. So, for instance, there, as many of you may know, one group that's incredibly prone to trafficking is African-American girls in the foster system in the United States. People literally wait for the day that they turn 18 and traffic, right? Or similarly, in many protracted war zones, it's always the socially marginal, the economically marginal, who are most prone to being trafficked. And what actually, ironically, enters into here is race, which is that Eastern Europeans who are trafficked in huge numbers, if they're able to make it to the United States, can often live a kind of post-slavery that's typically unavailable to black and brown people because of the logic of neo-slavery in this country. But the last point, and the one that with which I'd want to end, is that I think what's most important about contemporary slavery is the exact opposite of why I was saying I think people are willing to entertain it, which is that, in fact, what's remarkable about it is the continuities, that the people who are most likely to be trafficked are black and brown, they're from the global south, they're colonized groups, they're economically marginal. And in other words, they're a lot like people who were sold as slaves in the transatlantic slave trade. And I think what this means is simply that what we have to do instead of pitting these against one another is to say that there's no way to understand contemporary slavery as contemporary slavery if we don't do it through the lens of Egypt and Persia and Andalusia, of ancient and historical and modern, that these are of a piece. And that to understand them, we need to think of them in precisely that way, looking at the connections rather than pitting them against one another. And that I think doing that is actually a requirement for following this injunction that we're asked to follow each Passover. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much for your comments. My question is, why do you theorize that there is so much pitting against, to the point where, like, I've participated in a talk back after a production of The Whipping Man, and there was this immediate leap to, well, people are trafficked today. Yeah. And they didn't even really want to talk about the issues that had happened in the play that were contemporary for the 1860s. They wanted to leap to today. Why do you... I have my own theories. What are your theories and research? Why is that, do you think?
Will you tell me your theories? I'm curious.
My theories are, is when I've taught, I teach in Black Studies. Yeah. When I teach more old stuff, it's distant and safer, and people don't feel as complicit at all. Yeah. And the more I bring it to contemporary times, the more I talk about the contemporary realities of things that have happened in the not at all distant past, it gets to be more... People get their back up. People feel like they must have, I never owned and I never used that. They get very defensive without, and they do their best to not critically analyze what's happening, because then it takes away that defense mechanism that they just did something wrong. It's that fundamental attribution error kind of. They did something wrong. I won't do this thing wrong, and I'm okay. So it's kind of a combination of things.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Thanks. It's interesting because when I teach Black political thought, we also, we begin with slave narratives. And by the time we get to now in the semester, slavery doesn't seem far away at all, right? And their connections to it, however mediated, seem very real and very lasting. But I think one of the things about contemporary slavery is that work of contextualization that would actually connect them equally hasn't yet been done. And I think that there's an extent to which the people who've really pushed the issue of contemporary slavery have been very smart rhetorically in framing its newness. And I mean, they've radically pushed the divorcing of these phenomena from their much, much longer roots, you know. But I think, to be honest, some of it is a deeply political question, which is ending enslavement is a really protracted political process, and one that we short-circuit as a society over and over and over again. But I think that as soon as one starts thinking about neo-slavery and sort of slavery's legacies, it also raises all kinds of questions about how limited our conceptions of freedom are and how limited our experiences of freedom are. I mean, one of the things that I love to ask my students is whether we've actually moved beyond mastery as a model of freedom. And it bugs them out because they sort of think, I don't want to be a master. But then I say, well, what does freedom mean to you? And it's completely dependent on having enslaved people, either working directly for them or keeping the society going. And so I do think that some of it is just that we haven't yet made those connections, that the newness enables it to be decontextualized, to seem like it's elsewhere. And I think it also, it frames the United States as this sort of savior rather than the bad guy. And that there's such a deep desire to be post-racial that the images of sort of contemporary slavery, they always feature white women, even though white women are not the majority. And they feature Christians. I mean, they enable people who want to frame themselves as victims rather than as people responsible for harm to do so, even though it's completely phony and not actually defensible once you start studying it. And I think some of it, too, is that there's less scholarship on it yet. So there are fewer people calling them to account. And so I think there are multiple different reasons, in other words. But I've encountered what you're saying as well, which is that I think that the way that contemporary slavery typically gets talked about is so dehistoricized. It's not linked to questions of political economy typically. And so it seems like a moral crusade that has very clear rights and very clear wrongs. Whereas as soon as you start actually pushing it, why is this the case? And you know, it becomes the much more complicated beast that the transatlantic slave trade was as well. But I do think it's a major liability, the pitting of these things against each other. And it shocked me. When I started to work on contemporary slavery, I saw it as a Black Studies project and as a feminist project and as a Marxist project. And I quickly learned that feminists hate the discourse, Marxists hate the discourse, and Black Studies folks do too. And all for completely credible reasons. Yeah. Yeah. Hey.
Okay. So I'd like to go back to what you were talking about with the intersections.
Yeah.
So I've only been an assistant professor here at UNO for 3 years, so I'm still learning about Omaha's community.
Okay.
And what I've learned is that North Omaha, which is predominantly African-American, used to have a really vibrant Jewish community, and it was sort of coexisting until early 20th century. There were some catalysts to, you know, some things that happened, some race riots and whatnot, you know, that split that up. And I wondered if you could talk about if a similar thing was happening in Chicago or even in South Africa, where these two communities of Jewish people and African-American people or, you know, African people were coming together and, you know, if they were coming together, I guess, if you saw those two intersecting.
Absolutely. Great question. Yeah. There's a book by a woman named Cheryl Greenberg that's a history, a sort of a long history of Black Jewish relations in this country. And she makes this sort of passing point along the way that I think is like the key point in answer to your question, which is she says for Jews who could pass as white in this country who were communists, they saw their alliances with Black communities as indispensable to the project of radically changing the society, because their view was that their whiteness gave them incentives to be complicit with any privileges that came their way, and that they needed Black allies to point out, to sort of keep them from going there. And she compares that starkly with Jewish liberals. And her argument about Jewish liberals is that Jewish liberals were really important allies to Blacks in this country for a very long time, but that the big shift in the late 1960s was that a lot of the civil rights gains they were able to access in ways that Blacks were not. And so a lot of that civil rights legislation, the main beneficiaries, I mean, the same is true of affirmative action, right? The prime beneficiaries of affirmative action are white women, right? The prime beneficiaries of civil rights were ethnic whites like Jews, right? Who had faced very real restrictions, but there was a much greater willingness to incorporate them into white American society than was the case for Blacks. And a lot of the splitting came in exactly that moment. It didn't follow with the Jewish communists because their view was this model of assimilate. We don't want to assimilate into what exists. We need to completely transform this. And I'm belaboring this because the same is true in South Africa. The Jews who remained allies to Blacks as whiteness became available to them were people who didn't want to assimilate into what was available, who said we need a completely different model of sort of what it is to be a citizen who fully belongs. Does that help? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We just had the Goldstein Lecture for Human Rights and Lisa Christine, who actually is responsible for the photography exhibition, give a talk. And there was one thing that shocked me, I heard it from several people afterwards, and that was that people didn't know that slavery was such a big problem,
right?
And didn't know that it was at all even connected to them.
Right.
And we were given different ways that we could see how that was precisely the case.
Right.
But I was wondering if you could talk about other forms of slavery in the United States today and around the world that right. are more evident. You know, I'm thinking of things like the prison system,
right.
it, you know, where people are incarcerated and have to. Are you including slavery inside prison, being forced to work in prisons as being slavery? And what are the other examples that you might give
sure.
us for that?
One of the things that I've been doing, and I'm still trying to figure out whether I think this is the right way to parse this, it's something I've been thinking about for a long time, is I tend to think of incarceration as neo-slavery. And the reason I say neo-slavery is that it's structurally different from sort of historical transatlantic slavery, but the net results are more or less the same. That the black life is devalued, that the relationship between actions and that for which you're held responsible doesn't make sense without centering slavery as part of how it is that those sort of, how the criminal justice system produces those results. But the reason I call it neo-slavery as opposed to simply slavery is that these instances that are photographed here are ones where people are laboring without pay under threats of coercion, right? And I'm enough of a Marxist to not like that definition because there are so many options where you can't leave terrible work because there aren't alternatives. And I think those are comparable to neo-slavery as well. But I do think that I tend to call the continued grammar of the slavery that we had in this country neo-slavery. And this other stuff, slavery. And one of the reasons why is I think, and this does connect to creolization, is that I think with any human institution, even one that's deeply fundamentally dehumanizing like enslavement, it's not going to remain the same, right? I mean, if slavery is about generating profits from dehumanizing people, and then the whole edifice that comes around to make sense of that and to try to rationalize it, that's going to look different under different political economic situations. So it makes perfect sense to me that slavery looks the way it does now, as opposed to the way it did for the Euro-modern world where transatlantic slavery was the norm. And if you think about sort of the way it is that things are produced today, the way that responsibility gets diffused through global supply chains, et cetera, the fact that race has become, we now have this sort of globalized racial order where there are different racial logics that are converging. And so there are multiple different ways of being a vulnerable racialized subject that are different around the Atlantic Ocean versus the Pacific versus the Indian. And so we really, I do think that that is slavery, and that something like mass incarceration, it's instead of people being enslaved to a plantation, they're enslaved to the state. I mean, it's neo-slavery, there's no doubt. But it is different from what I would call sort of literal slavery. And there's no moral currency to those evaluations. It's an effort to parse them with some historical specificity, because it means that what we have to do in response is different. But I wouldn't put mass incarceration as slavery, but I would frame it as neo-slavery. And I think our society is full of neo-slavery. I think the girls being trafficked at 18 out of the foster care system, those are slaves, not neo-slaves. And I think the difficulty is even when they're freed from trafficking, they then occupy the society as neo-slaves, which isn't true for some of the other people who are literal slaves who are then freed. Because, say, they're Southeast Asian or they're Eastern European, they fit a different racial logic when they land on this side of the Atlantic than they do when they're still in Europe or in other parts of Asia or in Africa. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
There was a little bit of another part as well.
Okay, yeah.
Which was, I was surprised that it was kind of the inability of people that went to the former lecturer that were just like, what, slavery? What are you talking about? We haven't, seen that. And I'm thinking just your experience, for example, in South Africa.
Right.
You know, was this something that people, maybe not slavery so much, but apartheid, did people actually see it, or did they have mechanisms that made it so that they didn't see it?
Yeah.
What would those mechanisms be that are blinding us, and are they similar to what we see in other places?
No, thanks for the follow-up. Yeah, no, I've been thinking a lot. This connects to the question about teaching about these themes. And I've been thinking a lot about what you achieve when you make something a moral failing. So for instance, most students are really concerned about appearing racist, white students, because appearing racist is a moral failing. It doesn't mean they're actually committed to eradicating racism, but they don't want to appear as having, done this thing called seeming racist. Right. And I think it's quite similar with slavery. And the reason I say that is nobody would say I endorse slavery. nobody would say slavery is beneficial for the slaves, which was a commonly circulated idea when slavery was practiced. But at the same time, varieties of forced labor have existed from the, you know, the minute the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. There's still forced labor of all kinds of varieties. And people knew that there was forced labor. I mean, it was not hidden. I mean, there were all of these different labor schemes, and they were evaluated according to how well they approximated enslavement, right? And but there was the sense that there was this moral victory. And I do think it's a victory, right? Because there was a period where people thought slavery was okay. And so I think saying that it's not is a victory, but it's a very slippery one. Because then it encourages people not to recognize all of these things that are like the thing that they're supposed to be united in hating and that we're supposed to have formally triumphed over. So I do think it helps to create a psychological distancing that makes us very ill-equipped to recognize all the things that approximate the thing that we've all decided that we hate and that there's a consensus that we hate. And in terms of the question of apartheid, it's a great one. I think moving between Chicago and there was one of the things that I found so illuminating was that, I mean, Paul had mentioned my folks, and one of the things that was really striking to me when I visited apartheid South Africa was that you had absolutely mediocre white people. And what I mean by mediocre is people who hadn't accomplished anything. But the structure of the apartheid state rewarded them simply for being. And so I had cousins who were, I mean, they were salesmen, you know, I mean, and not particularly effective salesmen, and they sold vacuum cleaners. But they lived like, you know, very, very well. They had swimming pools and they had maids and they had, you know, and they obviously thought that that was absolutely, that there was nothing strange about that. And the reason I mentioned Paul's comment is in my own family, anybody who had something had it through education. And so the idea that they hadn't achieved in terms of education, I mean, they hadn't done anything remarkable and yet were rewarded. And then when I went home with the maids of one of my cousins and saw how she lived, that she had been away from her family for that entire day to be with my cousin's family, and that she was living in a tin, you know, there's no running water, and that just seemed okay, was so much of what apartheid did. And I think, you know, one of the things that when I was talking about encouraging students to see the legacies of enslavement in this country is that's still so live and well. I mean, there's this sense of sort of the value of white life, however ordinary, that's so in the fabric of this society, and that black extraordinariness can just be treated so casually. And this is where I see the incarceration issue, is there's this just absolute waste of black life. And then complete callousness that would represent loss for the families of those people. That doesn't make any sense if it's not for the ongoing legacies of how we normalized enslavement. Because it doesn't make any sense otherwise. I mean, it just can't make any sense otherwise. The thing that boggles my mind as a parent is sort of the callousness with which people like Trayvon Martin's mother or Michael Brown's mother, the way that you know that they're treated. That's not a national loss, and that we don't look at ourselves with just moral, you know, just horror, that we just proceed, you know, in the aftermath of those kinds of events. But I do think this sort of the moral victory comes with political costs. And I think it's something that we really need to struggle with, because a lot of the left in the academy seeks moral victories. We want our students to know what to say and to sort of know how to respond and to know the anger that they should feel. But sometimes the mastery of that, I think, exhausts the energy that people could devote to thinking through what actually to do about those very things that need so much work.
Okay, so you talked a bit about political economy, and so, and then earlier when you were talking, you mentioned socialism and communism, and I'm a sociology professor, and I've got some grad students here, and so, and we talk about that a lot. So I was wondering if you could speak to your thoughts on how varying political economies or economic orders specifically maybe could be used as sort of, I don't know, if you think that that's the solution, or if you're critical of those ideas, and I'll come back up for another question later.
Okay. Okay. I do think that that we're in the middle of a period of another period of primitive accumulation. And so, you know, Marx at the end of volume one talks about primitive accumulation and basically says this is the period which is the prehistory of capitalism where people just go and seize the raw materials, the land, the labor that then becomes the capital with which they keep reproducing their profits, right? And Rosa Luxemburg sort of came along and said, that even if Marx didn't intend it, in framing it as a prehistory, he acted as if it was one moment that happened then, and then the brutality gets sort of normalized and more mediated in the nature of capitalist relations. And she said, no, that process continues with processes of colonialism. I mean, that it's ongoing, that there's sort of that there are these periods of these sort of grabs that are much more where the violence is on plain display, right? And I think we're in the middle of one of those grabs. And that's exactly why you're seeing this, you know, just the rise of just sheer brutality and slavery, right? That we're in a moment of sort of the reorganization of the political, of the global political economy. And so I do and don't think that they're political economic fixes, right? In the sense that, you know, I do think that neoliberal policies, that you see a direct correlation between neoliberal policies and enslavement. I mean, the two are a one-to-one relationship. And it's not to say that states have a great abolitionist record. They don't, right? I mean, states were complicit with enslavement. But there's a certain point where states are very useful at intervening in certain kinds of abuses. But one of the things that's really marked this, you know, this recent period since the 1990s is that finance capital can move with much more freedom than labor can. And so it means that if you need to move as a laborer, you increasingly have to do so under vulnerable conditions. And there's an economy that's built off of that very vulnerability. And that's the economy of trafficking. And so one of the things that you're really seeing now is that we've outgrown the political institutions we need to guard people against vulnerability and turning it into something that's lucrative. And so part of it is political economy, but part of it is definitely political, that we've outgrown our political institutions. We need ones that are both smaller and larger than what we've got and that are much, much more global, and where belonging actually follows labor and contribution rather than the very old-fashioned conception that we have of citizenship, which is really based on the notion of conversion. And so I think if we had versions of membership that better tracked with where people were actually laboring and a much better recognition of what should count as labor, you know, so that it includes things like domestic labor, it includes sex work, it includes, you know, the vast majority of forms of work that people do today, that we would do a far better job at sort of equipping ourselves to respond. But one of the things that I think is a real challenge, I mean, we were talking about challenges in the ways that neo-slavery, I mean, that historical slavery and contemporary slavery are pitted against each other. Another one is that a lot of the people who are most aware of these issues are anti-statist. And often for very good reasons, which is that their relationship to the state is as a predatory, alienating, primarily punitive institution, right? But I think the response to that isn't to remain anti-statist, because I do think we need states to respond to these kinds of issues. But I think we need to demand better states, you know, and ones that actually function in ways that expand freedom rather than further in, you know, entrenching our enslavement.
So also as sociologists, we tend to be very critical about the societies we live in and the issues. But we might not be the best at coming up with solutions. And so we tend to polarize, right? So, you know, it's either burn it down and start over, or let's do the protest march. Or, you know, so when you think about solutions to some of these issues, what do you think? I mean, in terms of actual activism, what are some ways that we could work to try to solve some of the social problems?
Yeah. I mean, my first answer, because I'm also a professor like you, is the education piece. And it goes back to what Curtis was saying as well, is that I think there has to be a much less hyperbolic way of talking about contemporary slavery. I mean, I think part of what cultivates such an allergic response to it from a lot of people who are activists and are already politically mobilized is this effort to divorce it from all of these other issues that are so longstanding. But I think one of the first pieces, Paul and I were talking about this earlier, is that we're such an ahistorical society. And these are phenomena that you just can't even begin to get out without that understanding. But I was also, since Trump's been elected, I have to admit, I watch comedy shows as therapy. You know, sort of the week comes and I sit down with my John Oliver and my Bill Maher and just laugh out loud. But I was thinking about something that John Oliver had said, which is one of the best ways to pass genuinely evil policies is to surround them with things that are boring. You know, and he said it in jest. He was saying that you can get people to sign on. He was talking about net neutrality and the eradication of net neutrality. But I think as a society, that's a real liability, because a lot of the actual political work we need to do is pretty boring. I mean, there's a lot of day-to-day policy making, day-to-day accumulating of political currency that we don't really like to engage in. And this is somewhere where the comparison with South Africa is, for me, very profound, is that when the average South African is so much more politically informed and politically engaged and politically interested than most Americans are. I mean, I think one of the reasons why moralism has the traction it does in the society is it's easy. I mean, you can sort of master moral postures really fast, and it's easier to master them if you don't know that much about the intricacies of the issues, you know? And so, I mean, I really think kind of thinking in a fresh way about what it is to be political people and what that means in terms of being informed and the educational work we do, but also the sort of the mobilization is really key, because I do think we've mistaken politics for moralism, and especially when it comes to Black politics, because there's people much prefer Black moral voices to Black political voices. It's one of the reasons why having a Malcolm X festival is so key. He's a political voice through and through and through. But people loved Obama because he was a moral voice. And they won't forgive him for the moments when he was a political voice. And, you know, and there's much that Obama did that I completely disagree with. I mean, I think he was able to come to power precisely because he promised the expansion of neoliberalism. But as a statesman, he was remarkable. I mean, as somebody who actually engaged in this kind of day-to-day politics, and, you know, and I, too, was completely suspicious about the sort of bipartisan purple stuff. But I get it in the sense that he didn't want what he achieved to be simply rolled back as it's being done right now because of the nature of our two-party system. But I think having a much more coherent sense of political responses and then political institutions is really key. And I mean, what I would say about Passover, ironically, is I think it's an invitation to do exactly that kind of thing. And one of the reasons why I get really mad at my own people is that I think Judaism's really good at calling us to engage in exactly that kind of reflection, but that we too have often become party to this kind of moralism where we're above the fray and we're the people who are to sit in evaluation of other people's responses to their suffering.
Okay, I'm not like good like in speaking, but would you like tell us a little bit about like what is the child labor in South Africa, and also like relate to like the that the low skilled worker, like especially like people who are trucked from like Mexico, come here, work.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the interconnection regarding like, your research and like as a political science major, what is your policy recommendation on that?
Sure. Okay. No, thank you. Yeah. It goes back to the question about political economy, right? Which is that a lot of people blame parents for the enslavement of their children. When in fact what they should blame is the poverty that leads parents to sending their kids into arrangements where they think that they're going to be cared for, or they think that they're going to be sent to school, but instead they're sent to labor, right? And my honest view of this question has everything to do, ironically, it connects back to this country as well, with the way that we've decimated rural areas and destroyed the ability to have sustainable farming in rural areas, because that's the primary driver of child labor. In almost every instance, children who are enslaved have origins in rural communities that have been decimated by corporate farming. And so I love to tease my daughter because she's a vegetarian, and she sort of says, the way that you treat animals is cruel. And I say, do you know what corporate agriculture has done to humankind, right? That it is not above the fray. Because no, the number one driver of child slavery is the decimation of rural areas, and that the families who are there are so poor that typically they're trying to find makeshift solutions because the state is not offering public education. And so they send their children. And I've seen examples of this in the Caribbean very close up, where there are families who are trying to do everything they can to assure that their child has a childhood. But what ends up happening is there are people sort of sitting ready to employ to send those kids into situations of enslavement. And so I think the question of what to do is massive. But the reason I say it connects to this country is I think one of the major failings of the Democratic Party in this country is to think about a left politics for rural areas that actually addresses rural poverty in a way that instead the Republican Party has swooped in and tried to do.
I would like to take the opportunity to ask a last question.
Sure. Is it about creolization?
No, it's okay. it's about disasters and the disastrous.
Oh, okay.
A theme of that 2009 book.
Yeah.
Are the stars falling?
Yes.
Speak a little more about that.
Sure. Well, one of the arguments that we make in the Book of Divine Warning is that monsters are actually signs and symbols and literally warnings, right? That the word monster, the etymology of it, is linked to words like to demonstrate and to show. And so, in fact, when monsters show up, it's actually a good thing because it means that there's still time to do something. And so what I would argue about contemporary slavery and many of the sort of contemporary slaves and images of it is that they're forms of divine warning, but that it's not too late. So that the stars are falling, but there's still time to do something.
With that, I'd like to say thank you very much and appreciate your visit to Omaha.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jane Gordon, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Connecticut, and author of Why They Couldn't Wait, A Critique of the Black Jewish Conflict Over Community Control in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and Creolizing Political Theory, Reading Rousseau Through Fanon. She spoke on the topic Slavery Then and Now, Passover Reflections. This program, sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 11, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Curtis Hutt, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Special Programs Coordinator with the Schwalb Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.